You're listening to ABC Radio National with me, Nick Bryant, on Saturday Extra. And now we're going to bring you one of our biggest interviews of the year. It's with Australia's 28th Governor-General, Her Excellency, the Honourable Sam Mostyn. She took up the role of being the King's representative in Australia in July last year, and she's only the second woman to do that job. We caught up earlier in the week at her official Sydney residence, Admiralty House.
Governor General, thanks so much for joining us on Saturday Extra.
Thank you for coming to Admiralty House to do this.
Well, it's fantastic. I mean, we've got the most glorious view, haven't we? We're overlooking the Opera House and Sydney Harbour. It's fantastic to be here. I know when you were pondering whether to take this job or not, your then 24-year-old daughter said to you, there's no point in doing it unless you enjoy it. There's no point in doing it unless you have fun. Are you having fun in this role?
Well, she actually said something a bit more pointed. And she said, you can only take this job if it'll make you happy.
Ah.
And she was pointing to stuff I think our children tell us when we're not asking the right question of ourselves. And she said, you keep talking about service and showing up and duty, but will it make you happy? And she was the only person who asked that question in all of the time in which I was reflecting on it. And it does make me happy. And if it hadn't, if I couldn't imagine that it would make me happy and now say that, I shouldn't be in the job. Because I think in order to do this job well, there has to be some deep sense that doing the job is satisfying and more than just being the person, but to see what the job and what this role and what this office and what our democracy is doing, that brings me some happiness in the midst of a very busy program and many, many parts of the protocol attached to the job. But I'm very happy and I'm very privileged to have been asked, and I'm pleased I said yes.
Here's something I do think I got right. You've said that this job has revealed Australia to you in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also revealed certain aspects of yourself. I wonder, first of all, what have you learned about Australia?
I learn every day what comes from having two parts to my job that is rare in Australian public life. It's a panoramic view. So I necessarily get a panoramic view of Australia as this continent and our place in the world. And then I have fine grain community moments almost every day. So I'm moving between the fine grain of Australia, the weft and weave of how we operate in communities, in our daily lives, and then stepping back and looking at the grand picture, I guess, of Australia. And so what it's revealed to me is that there is so much good in this country. Someone earlier today described it as you have the golden ticket when you're in this country. There is something quite extraordinary about being on this continent at this time with all of our advantages and with this great story, the braided story of 65,000 years of attachment to the continent with Aboriginal people, then the British institutions, and now our 50, 60 years of successful migration. But that story is unique to us. So what I've learnt is that, and what I see every day, is that the stories we often tell ourselves through the media, or people are trying to tell us about division and about what we're not doing so well, can mask something quite extraordinary that's going on every day around this country, should we choose to pay attention and support the very good things and good people who keep showing up.
You said something interesting there, on this land at this moment. What is it about this moment in particular which makes you think we are so lucky and so blessed to be in Australia?
Part of it is the geography, where we sit in the world on this extraordinary continent. We don't share a border with another nation. We share oceans, but we are a vast continent with extraordinary riches that have come from that. We sit in a part of the world that is the future of the planet, I think. The Asia-Pacific, the Indo-Pacific, these are where the nations are on the rise and that matter so much to Australia, where so many diaspora communities from those nations have chosen to call home. We're living through a modern period where we've learnt to understand why it matters that we care about what happened 65,000 years ago. So we're learning to listen, I think, to the generosity of First Nations people sharing that story of tens of thousands of years of attachment to this country and to eldership. And we're also at a time when the rest of the world, I think, is struggling to know what it means to have a strong democracy, what matters about people and people's relationship with their governments. We have one of the most successful democratic systems, underpinned by communities that know that when they choose new governments, there won't be violence in the streets. So you can change governments, you can influence policy, so our compulsory voting. Everything about us at the moment is structured, I think, to say we are not just lucky. I think that lucky country story is for another day perhaps, but we have advantages, and should we choose to invest in them and think about them in I think a very positive sense, but also know what threatens that and know what where threats do come from. And at this time I meet those that are third, fourth, almost fifth generation Australians whose lives and stories started somewhere else decades and decades ago because of their families coming from somewhere else. That's in total, with migration and refugees, almost 9 million Australians whose story starts somewhere other than Australia. And the last place I see it, which I'm really proud of because I travel the world a lot on behalf of Australians, is I think about a third of the people who represent us in our embassies and high commissions around the world today were not born in Australia.
Mm, that's an extraordinary stat.
They came from other places as migrants, sometimes as refugees. They join our Foreign Service, our Department of Foreign Affairs, wanting to be representatives and tell the great story that they've seen through their life as Australian citizens back to the world. And it connects us to world stories that are sitting here in Australia. We don't have to go looking for it. We live it in our incredibly diverse communities.
Well, you represent Australia on the international stage. You tell that Australian story. What do you tell people around the world when they ask you to explain Australia, when they ask you to make sense of Australia?
I've got a richness of things I could speak about. Part of it is just a pride in how far we've come. We're a young nation. We're still relatively young in our modern context. But I talk about our impact on the world. And if I use Mongolia as an example.
You're in Mongolia.
I was in Mongolia a few months ago on a visit. An Australian head of state had not visited, or representative head of state had not visited for over 30 years. Bill Hayden was the last person to do that when he was Governor General. And what made me so proud about being in Mongolia was that a third to a half of the Mongolian cabinet and most of the leaders of the cultural institutions and the big shifting parts of their economy are people who trained in Australia, came to Australian universities, and they're known as Mozzies, Mongolian Aussies. And when you meet and hear how important Australia has been to the development of nations, particularly nascent democracies, so Mongolia sits landlocked between two big autocracies, believes in Australia's form of democracy, and has an Australian connection through the Mozzies. And it was Gareth Evans who, looking at Mongolia back 35 years ago, built what was called the Australia Awards, which was to bring people from all over the world to Australian universities. So our education system, our higher education offerings to people to come and then take that back, whether it was English language or any number of other studies, to understand how they would then lead their democracies, their nations. I'm very proud of that. And those stories are often ones that I encounter because they're shared with me before I can tell the Australian story. I'm amongst it. I went to Vietnam on that same trip to celebrate the 50 years of our relationship, deep relationship. And you see in Vietnam, deep admiration for Australia, deep admiration for the massive diaspora of Vietnamese Australians that we have, but also cherishing what Vietnam has brought to Australia with entrepreneurial skills and the enduring economic relationship we now have that's growing. I think every story I find about who we are connected to the world, and then you know what we care about, our extraordinary natural beauty. Mm. Wherever I go in this country, the landscapes, the seascapes, communities that are so proud of their part of Australia, you know, they're also great stories to tell.
Diversity is obviously something you see as a great strength and a great soft power tool. It instantly makes these connections with our neighbours and other countries around the world. But you are making that case at a time when there is opposition growing to immigration in the United States, in Europe, to a certain extent here. We're seeing it at the moment in a surge of support for the One Nation Party. Is that argument and that story harder to tell in Australia at the moment?
It shouldn't be. It should be something we're really proud of. And perhaps the language has got us trapped, whether it's diversity, inclusion. I like to speak always about the fact that in this country, if we do it right, people belong. Mm. And that when you have a sense of belonging, wherever you started, whatever you're doing, if we can nurture the sense of why people feel they belong in Australia and what the contribution is they're making and have always made as part of the big National Australia kind of modern project, the story I tell is I can't imagine our success as a nation without this grand narrative that is these three intersecting braided strengths, which is really brought to completion by the migration and refugee stories of the last 50 and 60 years. And I get to sit now at citizenship ceremonies, as mayors do in all of their local government areas, and I get to see, as they do, the faces of the people about to take citizenship to become Australians and committing to our values, having done the citizenship test, which most people born here have not done and haven't really thought about what makes us a great nation. And I sit there and think, this is what makes us great. We are still welcoming people who want to be part of Australia and call themselves Australians. I go to many culturally diverse communities and I'll start talking about their arrival and they'll say, we'd prefer you didn't call us multicultural. We'd prefer you didn't think we were still paying back some kind of obligation for when our parents arrived. We just want to be known as Australians, making our contribution to this country as Australians. And then I see that in all the school students who come through, particularly high school students who come through Government House in Canberra, 20,000 of them a year. The cultural mix of that cohort coming through as our future of this country is beautiful and diverse, and every one of them will say with a broad Australian accent how proud they are to be Australians.
So we should stop using phrases like DEI, we should stop hyphenating Australians, we shouldn't be talking about Chinese Australians and Indian Australians, that kind of thing. There's a terminology problem.
Well, I don't mind people who will describe themselves in a particular way as Vietnamese Australians or Chinese Australians. I think it's when we try to find the perfect word to describe all of this and we get lost in what's happening around the world, which is to unpack something that is seen as virtue signalling or somehow a woke agenda. There's nothing woke about this for this country. This is all about how we build strength. This is the ultimate architecture and strength of this nation. And without it, Australia would not be successful economically, socially, culturally. We're doing it in a way, should we choose to tell those stories back to ourselves, that would give us a sense of strength. And we are the envy of the world. So others looking at us say, you are doing something, you know, underpinned by an extraordinary set of democratic principles and processes and a history that we've dealt with over time, our engagement with the world. I'm in the business in this job of opening things up to say, what can we be proud of? I'm not blind to the tough things and the really hard things that our country goes through and people in our country go through, but I think sometimes we're telling a divisive story and that woke agenda being thrown up all the time, which does not represent the country I now see and have the privilege of seeing in this role.
On ABC Radio National, you're listening to Saturday Extra. I'm Nick Bryan, and I'm speaking with the Governor-General, Sam Mostyn. One of your roles is as the Commander-in-Chief of the Australian Defence Force. But that, to you, is not alien, is it? You've got a family history that's partly a martial history. Tell us about that, because I think a lot of people wouldn't necessarily associate that with you.
No, and I think there's some confusion about the job itself called the Governor-General and Commander-in-Chief. You don't have to be a general to do this job, even though the title is Governor-General.
And
the
a lot of military men have
done it, yes, and a lot of people probably look at it and think that is what the job is. And I can understand why that is the case if you set things up in that way. And Commander-in-Chief, I don't command the Australian Defence Force. That is the role of the Prime Minister, the Defence Minister, and the head of the Defence Force himself. But what I do is play a very significant role in celebrating, commemorating the things that our Defence Force does and has always done. And so it's a very important role. But one of the reasons I was happy to say yes to this role when the Prime Minister asked me was that I grew up in a military family. Mm. I'm what is known colloquially from the 70s and 80s as an army brat. Mm. So I'm the oldest of four girls, grew up in a family that was travelling quite a lot when we were very little for my father's military career. He was a Duntroon graduate, Signals Corps. So we grew up as kids in army mode. And I'm very proud of that because it in part made me who I am today. It also gave me a reason to say yes to the Prime Minister about understanding deeply what that part of this role is and how you need to understand our defence history, why those that serve must be supported and respected, and how you can do that without having actually served yourself.
Your dad's still with us.
He is. He's 91, living in Canberra.
You outrank him now.
So we do have an occasional laugh about this because I think he was very proud when I told him that I'd be the next Governor General. I then said that means Commander-in-Chief, and there was a moment I think was like, hang on, there's these pieces rearranging.
An upending of the family hierarchy.
Because he knew all of the previous Commanders-in-Chief, and many of them, in fact, and he had worked with during his military career. But we've had a good laugh about that. And, of course, I learned a lot from him, and I take him to a number of my ceremonies, particularly at Duntroon, where he graduated in 1955. He comes back when I do the graduation ceremonies there now as Commander-in-Chief. And I think there is a nice sense of completion there and an understanding that I know why I'm there and what this part of my role is to do and how to show that respect. And I've been going to Anzac Day ceremonies, to Anzac Day parades. I've been shining my shoes, turning up early and doing recces and reconnaissances as a young adult, because that's how we kind of were raised, that we're always thinking about showing up. We're big volunteers as a family, and I think that came with my dad's military service. And my mum, making sure the whole thing worked as a civilian, but of course having to give up a lot of things that she would have done in her life by marrying an army officer. and taking care of all of us.
Service is a running theme, isn't it, in your family? And I think when you were growing up in Canberra, you found yourself in Old Parliament House once, and you felt a sense of great belonging. You were clearly pulled towards public service from an early age.
It was weird. I don't have big memories of that time. I remember as a 10-year-old watching the dismissal from a gurney in a hospital, having my ankle band plastered. I broke my ankle the day
before. Well, that's slightly ironic, isn't it?
That is ironic.
As a future Governor-General.
That's what I was watching it on and you notice things in hospitals because the whole casualty department had stopped and we were watching these things. I didn't quite know what was going on as a 10-year-old. But I remember going through Old Parliament House when it was the Parliament House. There was no new Parliament House. And seeing people representing senators, members of Parliament, and thinking about what would it mean to represent people? It wasn't a conscious thought. I didn't then go off and study law or do any work with that in mind. But I do remember enjoying being in Parliament House in a place of democracy and history.
And you ended up working there. You ended up working for a couple of Labor ministers.
Yes.
Ended up working for a Labor Prime Minister, Paul Keating.
I did. Yeah, I worked for, I was a policy advisor for Senator Bob Collins and then Michael Lee. And then I worked for Prime Minister Keating in the policy areas of communications and arts.
But you were never a member of the ALP, I understand it.
I've never been a member of any political party. And in fact, I reflect on the time when policy advisers to the Australian government, the question was never asked about whether you were a member of the party or whether you supported the party. Those jobs were for people who had skills in the policy area. It didn't ever occur to me to talk about my politics. I've never spoken about my politics really with anybody. I don't think it's relevant to anyone, but I've never felt the need to join a party. But I do believe in service and volunteering and showing up and playing a role. And good policy has always intrigued me and how policy gets done well. So a lot of my career was working for policy organisations or having a role within the corporate world around making things better and showing up and thinking about the context from a policy perspective.
Now, one of the first times I think Australia became aware of Sam Mostyn was when you were appointed to be the first female AFL commissioner, Aussie Rules. And that was a surprisingly controversial appointment. A number of AFL clubs actually opposed your appointment, I think. How did that experience shape you?
When I look back over my career and the more preposterous things that I've done, that rates very highly. And it didn't feel preposterous going through the process. But once I said yes when offered the role and then arriving, I knew that I was involved in something that I thought was a popular thing to have done because of the way it had come about. The then president of the league, Ron Evans, had worked with the clubs to amend the constitution of the AFL to make a woman appointment because there had not been one in the history of the AFL. And waiting for one to turn up or be appointed had not achieved anything. And so he had a search firm approach 10 of us around the country to ask us to put our names into the ring. And we went through a very considerable process, 10 of us, and it got down to 4, then 2. And then I was the very fortunate person to be offered the role. There had been no commissioner ever appointed prior to that that had been done in that way, which I think is interesting because we were being tested on skills and capacity and what they were looking for. And so to have the appointment criticised heavily as being just about gender or just about a quota at the time, not just by men. There were some women who were not happy about it as well, thinking that you could only do those jobs if you'd been compared to the men who would be competing for it as well. So there was a lot to deal with going into that role. And I realised, in part of my learning all the way along, that there are sometimes risks you've got to take and show up and just do the job and stand for something in doing it. And I knew why I'd been appointed. I knew why Ron Evans wanted a woman around that commission table. 50% of those that support Aussie Rules are women. The mothers, wives, girlfriends had always played this massive role in the game and yet never given their right to be in the governance and rooms that were managing and leading the game. And then subsequently, as I discovered when I was approached by a lot of women, they hadn't had their own league, hadn't been given that respect. So it was an important thing to do. And it gave me a sense and a chance to engage at a really close level with one of the most important cultural phenomena in this country, which is sport. I'd always been sporty as a kid, but to be involved in the governance of one of the most successful professional sports, a men's sport then, that taught me a lot about how Australia works. And I carry that with me today. It's not the only thing, but it was a very important part of my own development.
Robert Hughes always said that sport is a great metaphor for Australian life. I mean, talking about symbolism, how, as Governor General, have you tried to change things in the office? I mean, we're sat in your study here, and the first thing I'm noticing is the beautiful art on the walls and the sort of art that it is. It's the art that tells you something about Australia and its history.
Well, thank you for noticing. When we arrived, Simeon and I, my husband and I, arrived and we looked at the places where the work of the Governor-General will be done, where we'd be inviting people to come in to participate in our great democracy, the patronages, community members, visiting heads of state. We thought about what are the walls, what's the story? The building says something. The Admiral's House originally here in Sydney and a former farmhouse as a Governor-General's residence in Canberra. What are these places telling those that come in of any background? For me, they weren't telling a story that was coherent or had some strategy behind it. And so I've always been involved and loved the notion that culture and art can tell us so much, the books we read, the plays we see, the music we listen to, the art we look at. And so I looked around and realised that one of the great privileges of the Governor-General would be to work with our great cultural institutions and ask them for help. And so I've engaged with the National Gallery of Australia, the Portrait Gallery, and increasingly the War Memorial to say, if I could give you a thematic about what I think the Office of Governor-General can do using these properties, can you help me with how we interpret that through art? And so I've worked with the galleries and the War Memorial, both in Kirribilli and in Yarralumla, to start showing that people... The theory is that most Australians could come into these houses and find some part of their story somewhere. And if not yet, then we keep doing it over the next few years and rotate things so that people see their stories reflected in these magnificent properties, but know that they belong, that they're seen. And these aren't places just of pure privilege that have a history about protocol and perhaps the crown, which is very important in my role, but we're so far from that in terms of how the a community needs to understand the modernity of the role of Governor-General. And I like to do that through an Australian lens.
Well, talking about the modernity of the role through a lens, you've become very kind of active on social media. I think you're the first social media GG, right?
Yeah, I think former Governors General, particularly the last two, I think did use social media to tell stories and to post pictures. I came at it from a slightly different perspective, I think, rather than just telling the story of an event. Well, I come at a time when, I think, to your earliest questions about what's happening in the rest of the world, the collision for me, or the potential collision of apathy and disinformation and misinformation in this country, that bothers me, that if they kind of encourage not to care about things and then to read only the things that come to you via an algorithm that's just factually wrong, what is the role of people, any person in high public office who has access to relevant information, important things, and to share those stories? And, of course, the modern form is social media. So we do use Facebook and Instagram and our website to not just tell the stories of who we engage with, but to teach what it is that makes us such a strong democracy and the role of the Governor-General within our parliamentary democracy.
You've mentioned the strength of Australian democracy a number of times there, and I totally agree with you. There's a kind of resilience about democracy because of the Australian model that makes it sort of safer, I think, and stronger than democracies, certainly in the United States and parts of Europe right now. But what also strikes me about Australia over the last sort of five or so years is it's faced some really serious sort of national convulsions. COVID, you know, had a splintering effect, I think, on Australia as the borders were closed. The voice referendum, I think, really sort of divided this country. And also now we have the fallout from the conflict in the Middle East, I think, has raised communal tensions as well. When you sort of throw in, you know, misinformation and all the other stuff, are you worried about the fraying of Australia?
I think anyone in these kind of roles, high public offices, and where we get to see from such a privileged view Australia, of course we worry. And I worry that that's a story, and particularly if we keep telling only that story back to ourselves, that can become a self-fulfilling prophecy. What I try to counter that with is that you can care less about something that you don't understand. If you have an understanding of something, you might begin to care for it more. And I put care and kindness and respect at the centre of everything I did. I said that to the Parliament on the day I was sworn in. And I've added to that modernity, visibility and optimism. And they're the six words that I use all the time about what does modern care look like? What does care for civics and our institutions look like in a modern context such that people wouldn't be apathetic or not care? So that's in part using social media. But it's also reminding people that in a world that can get fractured very quickly, stepping back and understanding what is our strengths and what every citizen's role is in that is a really important job, I think, of people who hold offices like I do. And so I do worry, but I also think step up, not just do what Sir Zelman Cowan, one of my predecessors, said, which was to reflect the light and shade of the country back to itself, to interpret the country, is actually to step deeper into that. And in terms of interpreting it, offer a set of opportunities to learn and to pay attention and engage. And if I can do that in a way that just gets a few more people thinking about, I wouldn't mind having a little look at the Constitution and where these powers come from and what is the role of the Governor General versus the Prime Minister, what does happen in Federal Executive Council that doesn't happen in Cabinet. These are all things that give people something that I think is at the heart of your question, which is lack of trust. If you don't trust these institutions and trust the people in them because you don't know enough about them, then of course you don't care. And that's where I think that fraying happens. And so I think people in my kind of role have got a duty to do more than just showing up. It's to unpack all of this and share the story generously and ask people to ask their questions and be curious and to debate the issues well and do it with respect. And that's part of what drives the care part of my job, is to share all that with Australians wherever I go.
We began by talking about what you'd learned about Australia through doing this job. The thing you didn't tell us was what you've learned about yourself.
I think I learn something about myself every day because whether it's through 210 patronages of organisations that do so much that lifts this country in so many different ways, or my proximity to the Defence Force, or watching the strength of our parliament, all the visits I make all around the country and around the world, I've learnt that I'm probably a prouder Australian than I ever gave myself credit for previously. Mm. I think sometimes as Australians, whether it's our tall poppy syndrome or our, you know, not wanting to step into being proud of what we have here, I'm a very, very proud Australian.
There's a culture of self-belittlement sometimes.
There is. And I probably would have been guilty of that, I think, in years gone by, of thinking, oh, you know, let's not get too ahead of ourselves or get too big for our boots. That worries me, back to your point about if the stories we keep telling ourselves are about we're not doing so well, we're fraying, we're divided, that could be our prophecy. Like we could step into that. So a sense of pride, a sense of absolute pride in who we are, celebrating every part of ourselves, doing it with respect for one another. I'm a very proud member of a community here in Australia that knows how lucky we are, but knows that luck can run out if we don't invest in it. And so I think I've learned that you've got to work hard in these jobs. I mean, I've learned that you've got to have a lot of stamina, got a lot of persistence.
Well, you see that on social media.
Yeah, and I also know I've learned that I'm resilient. I'm more resilient than I thought, because there are some that would probably still criticise the stories I'm telling and the way I'm telling it. And I have to look through that to the Australians I know who want someone to continue to care and put care and kindness at the centre of what we do in public office. And that's my true north for all Australians. And I want to meet every Australian on their terms, but I want to do it without a sense of violence or anger, because I think that's part of what we need to rebuild some trust in our systems.
And it was interesting what you were saying earlier about the word woke. I mean, some people have accused you of being woke. Yeah. Some people might be surprised to hear you speak like that.
The thing that disappoints me most is when we are posting a story about something I think is extraordinary in this country and the team decides we're going to turn the comment section off because of some vile commentary that's coming. It's always anonymous. It's horrible. It's attacking. It's fueled by an anger and a desire to be just really mean and nasty, but it's vile. And often, as a woman, it comes in various forms that has another whole other element to it. Many other women in senior roles have endured this. But it's a reminder of, for me, of how people still think it's okay to have the attack and to put it under the category of you're just woke, so I'm going to have a go. Mm. I think we're better than that, because the communities I go to, no one has ever done that to me face to face. No one, when they get to meet me, we spend time together, I get nothing but extraordinary revelation stories, engagement, and people who say, actually, I'm changing my mind about you. So I have had people come up to me and say, I thought you were something, and now I know you're not, and I just want to say you're doing a good job. They're great moments for me, because if they've believed the story that I've heard from people who've never met me, don't know about my values, don't know my family story or what I care about, they're the kind of stories that are out there all the time for all of us, actually. And that's what worries me, back to your fracturing comment, because none of that is real. The real thing are the people I meet and see. And the best conversations I have are when people say to me, I thought I knew you, but now, given what you're doing in this role, keep going. Keep talking about kindness. Keep talking about care. Keep showing up because we like this and we want to learn more. Keep putting up the teaching videos. We're intrigued. And so if I say I'm proud now, I'm proud that I do have a lot of those conversations around the country from people of all backgrounds, men and women, and they want people in these jobs to be showing up, I think, in this way.
Australia has learnt more about you.
I hope they get past some of the stereotype. I mean, we are all, if we're allowed to be, stereotypes that people build of us without taking the time to get to know us. And the thing I see in this job every single time, every time I meet a new person, is to stop and listen and let that person share who they are, because we make a profound mistake when we stereotype or use I think, our own views of people from for whatever reason, and misjudge and prejudge. And so my dad and my mum taught us very young, always meet people as you find them and always give everyone a chance to show who they are and find that point of connection. And I think Australians at the very best do that very, very well. We are open-hearted. I think it's something extraordinarily glorious about this place. And I see that so often in the people I get to meet and whose stories I get to share. For that part of the role alone, I feel enormous privilege.
Governor-General Sam Austin, thanks for sharing your stories on Saturday Extra.
It's been a great privilege. Thanks, Nick.
Stream any ABC radio station live and on the go. Discover new podcasts, music and audiobooks, all free on the ABC Listen app.